All right. So have you ever thought about like what happens after a death row inmate's trial is over? Like if they still have like avenues for fighting for justice,
Oh,
even if
absolutely.
it means
Yeah.
getting the state to like
Yeah.
pay for experts to challenge their conviction.
Definitely.
That's a pretty wild concept,
It
right?
is.
Do you
And that's a
think?
pretty crucial one, too, especially when you're talking about capital punishment, where someone's life is literally on the line.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we're diving into today with Owens v. Skate,
Oh, excellent
a
case.
1995 Tennessee Supreme Court case that
Yeah.
deals with this exact question.
It really digs into the heart of post-conviction proceedings and how far those rights extend. And it's fascinating how the court grappled with interpreting the law and how that bumps up against constitutional rights.
Yeah, and this isn't just like some abstract legal debate.
Yeah.
This has real consequences for ensuring fairness in the legal system,
Absolutely.
especially when the stakes are so high.
Especially in death penalty cases, right? It's not just about parsing words, it's about lives.
Yeah, so for all you law students out there, this case is like a masterclass in how courts balance these complex legal and practical concerns.
Yeah, a really good example.
All right, so to set the stage, let's talk about the two cases that kind of brought all of this to a head. We have Gail Owens and Purvis Payne, both convicted and sentenced to death in Tennessee.
Right.
Now, after they'd gone through all their initial appeals, they sought post-conviction relief,
Okay.
arguing that their original trials were messed up like there were serious constitutional violations.
Yeah, so that's the thing with post-conviction proceedings, right? They're like this safety net in our system.
Right.
They give people a way to challenge their convictions based on constitutional grounds after all the normal appeals are done. So you've had your trial, you've appealed it, and if there's still something fundamentally wrong with how things went down constitutionally, you can still fight it.
And so, what were Owens and Payne alleging? Specifically, what were they saying went wrong in their trials?
Well, they were pointing to things like ineffective assistance of counsel. Maybe their lawyers messed up in a way that violated their rights,
Oh.
or the possibility of new evidence coming to light, something that could change the whole picture.
Like potentially DNA evidence.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine you're convicted, and then years later, DNA technology advances, and now there's a way to test evidence that wasn't possible before.
Right.
That's what post-conviction is, for giving people a chance to bring that new evidence forward.
Okay, so they're facing the death penalty.
Yeah.
They're saying there were serious problems with their trials, but to actually argue these points effectively,
Right.
they needed expert help. So
Exactly.
they requested state funding to hire experts and investigators.
Yeah, because think about it. How can you convincingly argue that your trial lawyer messed up without having another legal expert examine their work?
Right.
Or how can you pursue new evidence like DNA testing without the money to pay for forensic
Yeah,
analysis?
that makes sense.
Yeah.
But the trial courts initially denied their requests, right?
Yeah, they did. They were referencing a previous case, Teague v. State,
Okay.
and basically their interpretation of Teague was that the state's responsibility to provide funding ended with the direct appeals process.
Gotcha.
So in their view, once those initial appeals were done, there was no obligation for the state to shell out more money for experts in post-conviction.
So this brings up a really important question then about how far the state's responsibility goes in ensuring a fair legal process.
Right, like does it stop at the trial level or does it extend further into
And
post-conviction?
especially in death penalty cases, right, where the consequences are so severe.
Absolutely. When someone's life is at stake, the idea of a fair process takes on a whole new level of
Now,
urgency.
before we go further, let's quickly define some terms for anyone who might be new to this.
Okay, good idea.
So, post-conviction proceedings are basically legal challenges that come after all the normal appeals have been exhausted.
Yeah.
It's not about arguing whether you're factually guilty or innocent anymore. It's about whether the trial itself and the conviction violated the Constitution.
Exactly. It's a different kind of legal battle.
Okay. And then there's the term ex parte hearing.
Oh, yeah, that's a key one in this
So
case.
what exactly does that mean?
An ex parte hearing is basically a private hearing where only the defendant or their lawyers get to present evidence to the judge.
Okay.
The prosecution isn't there.
Interesting. So why is that done?
Well, the idea is to let the defendant make their case for needing expert help without tipping their hand to the prosecution too early.
Ah.
You know, they might have sensitive information or legal strategies they don't want to reveal just yet.
Right.
So this private hearing allows them to argue for those resources without jeopardizing their case.
Okay, so we've got Owens and Payne facing the death penalty, claiming there were constitutional problems with their trials, and the trial courts saying no to their request for expert funding based on their understanding of Teague v. State.
Right, that's where we're at.
And this sets up the central legal question that the Tennessee Supreme Court had to grapple with.
Yeah, the big question.
Does Tennessee Code Annotated Section 4014-207B, which is the law that provides state funding for experts for poor defendants at the trial level, does that also apply to post-conviction proceedings in death penalty cases?
That's it in a nutshell.
And could these defendants even ask for this funding through a private ex parte hearing?
Two really big questions.
So let's break down the arguments from both sides. Starting with Owens and Payne, what was their main line of reasoning?
Well, their argument essentially boiled down to this post-conviction is just an extension of the criminal process. It's not some separate thing.
Okay.
Denying them funding for experts would seriously cripple their ability to prove potential constitutional violations.
So like in the case of ineffective assistance of counsel?
Exactly. How can you possibly show that your trial lawyer was incompetent if you don't have the resources to hire another legal expert to look over their work?
Makes sense.
It's like trying to build a house without any tools.
Right. You need the right equipment for the job.
And they were also making a broader argument about the inherent power of courts to ensure fairness.
Oh.
Like maybe even a constitutional right to this kind of funding to guarantee due process.
So basically they were saying, look, if the state is going to put someone to death, they have a responsibility to make sure the entire process is fair.
Yeah, and that includes post-conviction.
Okay, so that's Owens and Payne's side.
Yeah.
Now, what about the state of Tennessee? What were their counter-arguments?
So the state took a much more literal approach to reading the law.
Okay.
They were pointing to the specific language of that statute, section 4014-207B.
Right.
And they were saying, look, it explicitly talks about trial. It doesn't say anything about post-conviction proceedings.
So their argument was, if the lawmakers wanted to include post-conviction, they would have written it in there explicitly.
Exactly. They were saying the law is clear and we have to stick to what it says.
Okay. And they also brought up the Post-Conviction Procedure Act, right?
Yeah. They pointed out that that act specifically mentions funding for things like lawyers and court reporters.
Right.
But it's completely silent on experts and investigators.
So basically they're saying the legislature already addressed funding in post-conviction and chose not to include these specific resources.
Right. And to them, that silence speaks volumes.
And they also argued that there's no constitutional right to state-funded experts in these later stages of appeal.
That's right. They were saying that the Constitution guarantees certain rights at trial, but those don't necessarily extend to post-conviction.
So you can really see the clash here between strictly interpreting the text of the law and considering the broader goals of justice and fairness.
Absolutely, a classic legal dilemma, especially when you're dealing with the death penalty where everything is magnified.
All right, so let's get to the Tennessee Supreme Court's decision. Mm-hmm. What did they ultimately decide?
Well, the majority opinion written by Chief Justice Anderson really went deep on statutory interpretation.
Okay, so this is where it gets interesting.
Yeah, they started by saying that when a law's wording is ambiguous, when it's not crystal clear, the courts have to try to figure out what the legislature intended when they wrote it.
So it's not just about taking the words literally. It's about understanding the purpose behind them.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. So how do they go about figuring out that legislative intent?
They used a really interesting legal doctrine called in pari materia.
In pari materia. Okay. I've never heard of that.
Yeah. It's a bit of a mouthful, but basically it means that you should interpret related laws together to get a better sense of the legislature's overall goal.
So instead of just looking at one law in isolation, you look at it in the context of other laws that deal with similar subjects.
Exactly. Like imagine you're trying to understand a recipe.
Okay.
You wouldn't just look at the instructions for one step in isolation, right? You'd look at all the steps together to see how they fit into the overall process of making the dish.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So in Owens, the court looked at section 4014-207B alongside the Post-Conviction Procedure Act to try and understand the bigger picture of how the legislature thought about funding for indigent defendants, not just at trial.
Gotcha. So they were trying to see if there were any clues in those other laws that would shed light on this specific situation.
Exactly. They were looking for consistency in the legislature's approach to funding across different stages of the criminal process.
And what else did the court emphasize in their decision?
They were really concerned about avoiding potential conflicts with the Constitution, specifically with due process rights.
Okay.
They said that interpreting the law in a way that could allow for funding in some post-conviction death penalty cases would be more in line with those constitutional principles.
So they were trying to prevent a situation where someone might have a valid constitutional claim but couldn't pursue it because they couldn't afford the experts they needed.
Exactly. They were worried about creating a system where justice was essentially available only to those who could afford it.
Right, because that would be a huge problem.
A fundamental problem.
So did they just give Owens and Payne the funding they requested?
Not exactly, but this is where it gets really important for understanding the impact of this case.
Okay.
The court established what they called the substantial need test.
A substantial need test. Okay, tell me more about that.
So they ruled that to get state funding for experts in a post-conviction death penalty case, the defendant has to show that they genuinely need that expert help.
Okay.
And not just any need. It has to be a substantial need.
So what qualifies as a substantial need?
Well, they said it has to involve a complex issue, like maybe advanced forensic analysis or a highly technical legal argument, something that a regular lawyer wouldn't be equipped to handle on their own.
Right.
And they also have to show that their case can't be properly developed and presented to the court without this expert help.
So just saying I need an expert isn't enough.
Exactly. The court was very clear about that. They actually said, and I'm quoting here, an unsupported allegation will not suffice.
So the burden of proof is really on the defendant to make a strong case for why they need those resources.
Absolutely. It's not an automatic entitlement.
And this substantial need test, that's a pretty big deal, right?
It is. It's a significant hurdle that defendants have to clear before they can even get access to those resources.
So it's not just that funding might be available, it's that you have to jump through these hoops to even be considered.
Exactly. It's a much higher bar than just asking for help.
Okay, so how does a defendant actually go about requesting this funding and demonstrating that substantial need?
So the court laid out a specific procedure. To even get an ex parte hearing, remember that private hearing we talked about?
Yeah.
The defendant has to submit a written motion to the trial court.
Okay.
And in that motion, they have to explain exactly why, based on the specific facts of their case, they need those expert or investigative services.
And they have to connect it to their constitutional rights, right?
Exactly. They have to show that getting those resources is essential to protecting their constitutional rights.
Gotcha. So it's not just about proving their innocence.
Mm.
It's about proving that their rights were violated during the legal process.
Right, on the money.
And then what happens? The trial court just decides whether to grant the hearing based on that motion.
Yep. If the defendant can show that need in their motion, the trial court should grant that private hearing.
Okay, so now let's talk about the dissenting opinion. Was there a dissenting opinion in this case?
Oh, yeah. There was. Special Judge Lewis dissented, and he offered a very different take on the whole thing.
Okay, so what was his main point of disagreement?
Well, his opinion was rooted in what we call textualism.
Textualism.
Yeah, it's the idea that you should stick to the plain meaning of the words in a law.
So no reading between the lines?
Yeah.
No trying to figure out hidden intentions?
Exactly, just focus on the words themselves.
Okay, so how did he apply that to this case?
Well, he pointed out that the statute specifically said trial.
Right.
And it didn't mention post-conviction anywhere.
Right, we talked about that.
So to him, that was the end of the story. The law simply didn't apply to these later proceedings.
Gotcha. So he wasn't persuaded by the imperium materia argument or the concerns about potential constitutional conflicts.
Nope. He felt that the court was overstepping its bounds by trying to read into the law what wasn't explicitly there.
Okay. And what about the state's argument that the Post-Conviction Procedure Act already addressed funding and didn't include experts?
He agreed with that, too. He basically felt that if the legislature wanted to fund experts in post-conviction, they would have said so.
Okay, so he was really concerned about sticking to the letter of the law.
Absolutely. He saw it as a matter of judicial restraint, not going beyond what the lawmakers had clearly authorized.
And I imagine he was probably also wary of opening the floodgates to all sorts of requests for funding.
Yeah, he used the phrase fishing expeditions.
Right, like people just throwing out requests hoping something will stick.
Exactly. He was worried about that potential for abuse.
Okay, yeah. So ultimately, the majority opinion won out.
Yeah.
But what did that actually mean for Owens and Payne? Did they get the funding?
Well, the court didn't just hand them the money. Instead, they sent their cases back down to the trial court.
Yeah.
And they instructed the trial court to hold those ex parte hearings that we discussed.
Right. Those private hearings where the defendant gets to make their case for needing resources.
Yeah. And at those hearings, Owens and Payne would have the opportunity to try and meet that substantial need test.
So to convince the trial court that they really did need those experts to properly present their constitutional claims.
Exactly. It was a victory for them in the sense that they got another chance to make their case.
But it wasn't a guarantee of funding.
Right. It just opened the door a little wider.
Okay, so let's zoom out a bit. What are the broader implications of the Owens decision, and what can law students learn from this case?
Well, first of all, it expanded the potential access to crucial resources for people on death row.
Okay.
It gave them a pathway to potentially getting the expert help they need to challenge their convictions.
But it's not a free-for-all, right?
No, not at all. That substantial need test puts a pretty big obstacle in their way.
So it's a step forward in terms of ensuring fairness, but it's not a complete solution.
Exactly.
And this case is also a fantastic example of statutory interpretation in action.
It really shows you how judges have to grapple with ambiguous language and try to figure out what the lawmakers meant.
Yeah, it's not as simple as just reading the law and applying it blindly.
Right, you have to consider the context, the legislative history, the potential constitutional implications.
It's a much more nuanced process than people might realize.
Definitely.
And the court even said explicitly, where statutory language is ambiguous, courts must seek legislative intent.
A key takeaway for any aspiring lawyer.
Absolutely.
And Owens also highlights something really important about death penalty litigation.
What's that?
It's not always about guilt or innocence.
Okay.
Often it comes down to these intricate procedural rights.
So like whether someone's constitutional rights were violated during the legal process?
Exactly. And making sure that process was fair at every stage, even post-conviction, is absolutely crucial.
Yeah. Especially when the ultimate punishment is on the line.
Right. You can't be too careful when someone's life is at stake.
So let's bring this back to that hypothetical we talked about earlier about someone claiming their trial lawyer messed up in handling forensic evidence.
Okay.
Without the money to hire their own forensic expert to review the original findings and maybe find some flaws.
Right.
How can they even begin to make that argument in a post-conviction appeal?
It's almost impossible.
It's like needing a special tool for a specific job.
Exactly. You might understand the task at hand, but you can't actually do it without the right equipment.
And as the court said, an unsupported allegation for funds will not suffice.
Right.
They have to specifically show why that expert is essential to prove a violation of their rights.
And that brings up a really tricky question.
What's that?
How can someone on death row who probably doesn't have a lot of resources effectively investigate their case and demonstrate that substantial need?
Yeah, that's like a catch-22.
It's a real challenge, and it underscores the importance of having strong legal representation at the post-conviction stage.
So basically, even though Owens expanded access to resources, it doesn't completely level the playing field.
No, it doesn't, but it's a step in the right direction.
Okay, so to sum up the core holding of Owens v. State is that Tennessee Code Annotated Section 40.14.207b does apply to post-conviction death penalty cases.
But with a big caveat.
Right, it's not automatic.
Indigent petitioners have the right to an ex parte hearing to present their case.
Okay.
But they have to clear that high bar of demonstrating a substantial need for expert or investigative services.
To ensure their constitutional rights were protected throughout the entire process.
Precisely.
So Owens v. State, it's a fascinating case with some really important implications for the death penalty and the right to a fair trial.
It really gets you thinking about the complexities of the legal system and the challenges of balancing competing interests.
Yeah, and it definitely raises some tough questions about how to ensure justice for everyone, regardless of their financial means.
Definitely.
So for all you future lawyers out there, this case is definitely worth a close read.
It'll make you think critically about statutory interpretation, constitutional rights, and the ethical considerations of representing clients facing the ultimate punishment.
And it leaves us with a lot to ponder.
It does.
Like, how does this substantial need test actually play out in practice?
Right.
Does it truly help those who might be innocent get the resources they need to prove their case?
That's the big question.
Or does it create an insurmountable barrier for those who are already facing an uphill battle?
It's a question worth wrestling with.
Definitely. So I think we've given everyone a lot to think about today.
I hope so.
And hopefully this deep dive into Owens v. State has provided some valuable insights into the world of post-conviction litigation and the ongoing debate over the death penalty.
A crucial area of law with incredibly high stakes.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining me today for this deep dive. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise.
And for all our listeners out there, keep those legal minds sharp, and we'll catch you on our next deep dive.
Until next time.